Well, it is time for us to wish our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today a very happy birthday on this March 8th. We have Irene Crouch from Ogden, Jeffrey Barber from Slater, Richard Sampson from Des Moines, and Dennis Mather, also from Des Moines. All of us here at Iris would like to wish the four of you a very happy birthday. And this is a reminder, you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so that we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. There are no obituaries today, so I will just continue with an article from National News. From Washington, sky-high stakes for State of the Union. Biden faces challenge of selling re-election bid. President Joe Biden gave a pivotal State of the Union address Thursday as he looked to silence skeptics about his ability to keep serving, convince restless Americans the economy is strong, and reestablish the stakes of a likely rematch against Donald Trump. The results of Super Tuesday and subsequent withdrawal of Nikki Haley from the Republican primary makes this week the unofficial start of the general election. In what could be his final State of the Union address, the moment could not have been much bigger for Biden, who is saddled with challenges at home and abroad. Biden hears heckling regularly from pro-Palestinian protesters as he tries to navigate the U.S. role in the Israel-Hamas war, without further alienating his liberal base. He's not yet been able to assuage concerns about his age. Despite a booming stock market and historically low unemployment, Biden isn't getting credit for an economic rebound. His approval rating, already hovering in the low 40s for 2 years, dipped even lower in recent weeks. And, triggering anxiety among Democrats, Biden's fundamental re-election message is that the battle for the soul of America isn't over. Hasn't clicked yet for the majority of voters. Trump leads Biden in most polls nationally and in battleground states that will decide the election. But the State of the Union is a presidential showcase. This year gave Biden the opportunity to set the stage for November and flesh out contrasts with Trump that haven't yet crystallized among voters. What he needs to try to do is to begin to shape a narrative about the upcoming election, because right now he's on his heels. William Howell, a political scientist at the University of Chicago, said before the speech, "I think it's a huge moment," said Barbara Perry, director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. "This is sort of the kickoff of the real campaign. Biden needed," she added, "to hit it out of the park." To win in November, Biden must unite a fraying Democratic coalition with polling showing softening support for core constituencies such as Black, Latino, and young voters. He needs to enthuse those in his party who are clearly unenthusiastic about him to some degree and are concerned about his age, Perry said. A poll released March 2nd by the New York Times Siena College had Trump ahead of Biden 48% to 43% among registered voters. It underscored Biden's base struggles, finding that 97% of Americans who voted for Trump in 2020 said they will vote for him again in 2024. But only 83% of Biden voters from 2020 said they would vote for Biden this fall. The Biden campaign has long maintained that the president's struggling poll numbers don't accurately reflect where things will stand in November when the voters have a clear choice and consider the consequences of a second Trump presidency. In a memo the day after Super Tuesday, the campaign downplayed national polling against Trump, saying it confirms what we know to be true. This will be a very close general election contest. The memo said upwards of 10% of voters remain undecided, a share of the electorate much larger than the current margin between Trump and Biden in polling. They said that these voters overwhelmingly support Biden's policies, and the Biden campaign plans to aggressively engage with them. Biden spent a long weekend at Camp David presidential retreat working on the State of the Union address with top aides. Leaving for the speech-writing sessions, he carried a book that seemed to reflect the tests he faces. Possible. How do we survive and thrive in the age of conflict? In recent weeks, Biden has queued up his re-election themes. He emphasizes the need to protect American democracy and restore reproductive rights. He blames Trump's three Supreme Court nominees for overturning Roe v. Wade's constitutional right to an abortion. He has come out more vocally on migrants. Last week, during a visit in the U.S.-Mexican border in Texas, Biden challenged Trump to join me in pushing for a bipartisan border legislation bill, which includes some of the strongest enforcement measures in generation. Congressional Republicans killed the bill at the urging of Trump. On a positive side, Biden touts historic job growth and frames his record in bold terms. The White House has started saying he's accomplishing more in 3 years than most presidents have in 2 years. Biden says America needs to reelect him to protect his agenda on infrastructure, lowering prescription drug prices, and domestic manufacturing. And he has tried to position himself on the side of the working class by emphasizing efforts to take on so-called junk fees, lower health care premiums, and making corporations pay their fair share of taxes. But for all the policy talk, Biden's first order of business this election season remains convincing a public wary of his age that he's up for the job for another 4 years. Concerns about the 81-year-old Biden's status hiked up last month after a report from Justice Department Special Counsel Robert Hur portrayed the president as a, quote, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. From the State of the Union, Biden plans to hit the road, speaking in Philadelphia on Friday and Atlanta on Saturday, two battleground states, Pennsylvania and Georgia, that could decide the election. He is also dispatching cabinet members and other top officials across the country to amplify the message. If we can shape the terms of the debate, if we can shape this public sense about what's at stake in this upcoming election, he'll be able to recover some advantage that right now is slipping, Howell said.
And now I turn to the Nation and World Extra. This from Washington, D.C., a bill targeting TikTok advances in the House. A bill that could lead to the popular video sharing app TikTok being unavailable in the United States is quickly gaining traction in the House as lawmakers voice concerns about the potential for the platform to servile and manipulate Americans. The measure gained the support of House Speaker Mike Johnson and could soon come up for a full vote in the House. The bill advanced out of committee Thursday in a unanimous bipartisan vote of 50-0. The House, White House has provided technical support in the drafting of the bill, though White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said that the TikTok legislation still needs some work to get to a place where President Joe Biden would endorse it. The bill takes a two-pronged approach. First, it requires the ByteDance Limited, which is based in Beijing, to divest TikTok and other applications in controls within 180 days of enactment of the bill, or those applications will be prohibited in the United States. Second, it creates a narrow process to let the executive branch prohibit access to an app owned by a foreign adversary if it poses a threat to national security. It's an important bipartisan measure to take on China, our largest geographic foe, which is actively undermining our economy and security, Johnson said Thursday. Some lawmakers and critics of TikTok have argued the Chinese government could force the company to share data on American users. TikTok says that it has never done that and wouldn't do so if asked. The U.S. government also hasn't provided evidence of that happening. Critics also claim that the app could be used to spread misinformation beneficial to Beijing. Former President Donald Trump attempted to ban TikTok through executive order, but the courts blocked the action after TikTok sued, arguing such actions would violate free speech and due process rights. TikTok raised similar concern about the legislation gaining momentum in the House. This bill is an outright ban of TikTok, no matter how much the authors try to disguise it. This legislation will trample the First Amendment rights of 170 million Americans and deprive 5 million small businesses of a platform they rely on to grow and create jobs, the company said in a prepared statement. The bill's author, Representative Mike Gallagher, the Republican chairman of special House committees focused on China, rejected TikTok's assertion of a ban. Rather, he said, it's an effort to force a change in TikTok's ownership. He also took issue with TikTok urging some users to call their representatives and urge them to vote no on the bill. The notification urged TikTok users to speak up now before your government strips 170 million Americans of their constitutional right to free expression. The notification also warned that the ban of TikTok would damage millions of businesses and destroy the lives of countless creators around the country. TikTok users responded by flooding the offices of lawmakers with telephone calls. Some offices even shut down their phones because of the onslaught. A congressional aide not authorized to speak on the matter publicly said that lawmakers on the committee voting on the bill Thursday, as well as others, were inundated with calls. Today, it's about our bill, and it's about intimidating members considering that bill. But tomorrow, it could be misinformation or lies about an election, about a war, about any number of things, Gallagher said. This is why we can't take a chance on having a dominant news platform in America controlled or owned by a company that is beholden to the Chinese Communist Party, our foremost adversary. The bill comes about 1 year after TikTok CEO was grilled for hours by skeptical lawmakers on the House Energy and Commerce Committee, concerned about data security and the distribution of harmful content. That same committee met Thursday to debate and vote on the bill. Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers, the committee's Republican chair, said that TikTok's access to so many Americans make it a valuable propaganda tool for the Chinese government to exploit. She also noted that its parent company, ByteDance, is currently under investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice for surveilling American journalists. Through this access, the app is able to collect nearly every data point imaginable, from people's location to what they search on their devices, who they are connecting with, and other forms of sensitive information, Rogers said. To assuage concerns from lawmakers, TikTok has promised to wall off U.S. user data from its parent company through a separate entity run independently from the ByteDance and monitored by outside observers. TikTok says new user data is currently being stored on servers maintained by the software company Oracle. The American Civil Liberties Union and other free speech advocacy groups urge lawmakers to reject the TikTok bill, saying in a letter to the Energy and Commerce Committee's leadership that passing this legislation would trample on the constitutional right to freedom of speech of millions of people in the United States. Biden's re-election campaign has opened a TikTok account as a way to boost its appeal with young voters, even as his administration continued to raise security concerns about whether the popular social media app might be sharing user data with China's communist government. Jean-Pierre said that the White House welcomes lawmakers' efforts on the TikTok legislation, but lawmakers need to continue to work on it. Once it gets to a place where we think it's on legal standing and it's in a place where it can get out of Congress, then the president would sign it, she told reporters on Wednesday during the daily White House briefing. She also defended the White House efforts to limit the dangers of TikTok, even as the president engages with influencers on the social media platform, and his campaign hosts a TikTok account. We are going to try to meet the American people where they are, Jean-Pierre said. We are trying to reach everyone. The president is the president for all Americans, and it doesn't mean that we're not going to try to figure out how to protect our national security.
from Uvalde, Texas. Uvalde parents lash out after new report. Investigation clears police of missteps during shooting. An investigation Uvalde city leaders ordered into the Robb Elementary School shooting that killed 19 students and two teachers defended the response by local police at a city council meeting Thursday, prompting shouts of, quote, cowards from the audience and causing several family members of victims to angrily walk out of the meeting. The report acknowledged wide failures by police during the 2022 attack and reiterated rippling missteps that the Justice Department and state lawmakers had previously laid bare. Nearly 400 law enforcement agents, including Uvalde Police Department officers, rushed to the scene of the shooting, but waited more than an hour to confront a teenage gunman armed with an AR-style rifle. But an investigator hired by Uvalde officials found that the city's officers did not deserve punishment, and in some cases praised their actions during one of the deadliest classroom shootings in U.S. history. The presentation prompted an eruption of anger among some of the victims' family members, who also scolded the investigator for leaving the room before they had a chance to address him. Quote, "You said they did it in good faith. You call that good faith? They stood there 77 minutes, said Kimberly Mata-Robillo, whose daughter was among those killed in the attack after the presentation ended. Jesse Prado, an Austin-based investigator and former police detective who made the report for the Uvalde City Council, began his presentation by describing the failures by responding local, state, and federal officers at the scene that day. Communication problems, poor training for live shooter situations, lack of available equipment, and delays on breaching the classroom. There were problems all day long with communications and lack of it. The officers had no way of knowing what was being planned, what was being said," Prado said. "If they would have had a ballistic shield, it would have been enough to get them to the door." The city's report is just one of several probes into the massacre, including the Justice Department report in January that criticized the cascading failures of responding law enforcement. Law enforcement took more than an hour to get inside the classroom and kill the gunman, even as children inside the classrooms called 911, begging police to rescue them. But Prado said his review showed that officers showed immeasurable strength and level-headed thinking as they faced fire from the shooter and refrained from shooting into a darkened classroom. "They were being shot at from 8 feet away from the door," Prado said. Prado also said the families who rushed to the school hampered efforts to set up a chain of command as they had to conduct control with parents trying to get into the building or pleading with officers to go inside. "At times, they were difficult to control," Prado said. "They were wanting to break through police barriers." Family members erupted when Prado briefly left after his presentation. "Bring him back," several of them shouted. Prado returned and sat and listened when victims' families cried and criticized the report, the council, and the responding officers. My daughter was left for dead," Ruben Zamora said. "These police officers signed up to do a job, and they didn't do it." A criminal investigation by Uvalde District Attorney Christina Mitchell's office into the law enforcement response in the May 2022 shooting remains open. A grand jury was summoned earlier this year, and some law enforcement officials have already been asked to testify. Tensions remain high between Uvalde city officials and the local prosecutor, while the community of more than 15,000, about 85 miles southwest of San Antonio, is plagued with trauma and divided over accountability. Uvalde City Council member Hector Luvano said he was, quote, embarrassed and insulted by the city's report. Quote, "These families deserve more. This community deserves more," Lovato said. "I don't accept this report." The city report comes after a nearly 600-page report by the Department of Justice in January found massive failures by law enforcement, including acting with, quote, "no urgency to establish a command post, assuming the subject was barricaded despite ongoing gunfire, and communicating inaccurate information to grieving families." Had law enforcement agencies followed generally accepted practices in active shooter situations and gone right after the shooter and stopped him, lives would have been saved and people would have survived, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland said when the federal report was released. The DOJ reported that 48 minutes after the shooter entered the school, UPD Acting Chief Mariano Pargas continued to provide no direction, command, or control to personnel. The city report notes the agency's SWAT team had not trained consistently since before the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020. Three UPD officers who were present in the hallway during the shooting were the leadership of the SWAT team and had the most experience with Uvalde PD. Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott initially praised the law enforcement response, saying the reason the shooting was, quote, not worse is because law enforcement officials did what they do. He claimed that officers had run toward gunfire to save lives. But in the weeks following the shooting, that story changed as information released through media reports and lawmakers through their findings illustrated the botched law enforcement response. At least five officers who were on the scene have lost their jobs, including two Department of Public Safety officers and the on-site commander, Pete Arrendado, the former school police chief. No officers have faced criminal charges.
Prosecutors draw distinctions between Trump and Biden cases by Eric Tucker, Associated Press, Washington, D.C. Federal prosecutors on Thursday drew sharp distinctions in the classified documents investigations of Donald Trump and President Joe Biden as they urged a federal judge to reject the former president's claims that he was the victim of a vindictive and selective prosecution. Trump's lawyers told U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon last month that the felony prosecution of Trump should be dismissed in part because he had been charged with illegally retaining classified documents, while numerous other public figures were also investigated for the potential mishandling of sensitive records, including Biden, and had either not been prosecuted or faced much less serious criminal cases. But special counsel Jack Smith's team, in a court filing Thursday responding to that argument, said that Trump's conduct went much further than that of the other officials that he identified, and that none of them is alleged to have willfully retained a vast trove of highly sensitive confidential materials and repeatedly sought to thwart their lawful return and engaged in a multifaceted scheme of deception and obstruction. That scheme, prosecutors added, included not only Trump's own repeated efforts to stymie the investigation, but his recruitment and direction of his subordinates to join in the conspiracy, repeated efforts to stymie the investigation. But his recruitment and direction of his subordinates to join in the conspiracy. Trump and his lawyers have seized on the findings of a different Justice Department special counsel, Robert Hur, who said in a report last month that his team had uncovered evidence that Biden, as a private citizen, had willfully retained classified information, but that evidence fell short of proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, the standard required to bring a criminal prosecution. Cannon, on Thursday evening, scheduled a hearing for March 14 to hear arguments on several of the Trump's team's motions to dismiss, including Trump's claim that he was entitled to possess the documents under the Presidential Records Act, an argument that prosecutors have vigorously rejected. Prosecutors on Smith's team acknowledged that though there are superficial similarities in the cases, they stand apart in meaningful ways, including Trump's extensive and repeated efforts to obstruct justice and thwart the return of documents bearing classification markings. They cite the Hur report as noting that Biden, by contrast, alerted authorities to the presence of classified documents, willingly returned them, consented to searchers of his home, and otherwise cooperated with the investigation. Smith's team also says that though they gathered powerful evidence that Trump willfully held onto the classified records from his presidency at his Mar-a-Lago estate, including showing them off to others while commenting about their sensitive status, The HER report showed that such evidence against Biden was insufficient to establish criminal intent. The clear differential in the strength of the evidence on the crucial element of intent precludes Trump from showing that the two men are similarly situated, wrote prosecutors for Smith, who was appointed in 2022 by Attorney General Merrick Garland to handle Trump's related investigations. Other differences between the cases include the volume of documents found that were cleared. The records most at issue in the Biden probe are now nearly 15 years old, while the files recovered from Trump investigation are, of course, much more recent and concern information about U.S. nuclear programs and military and defense capabilities of the U.S. and foreign countries. And though the Biden documents for which charges were most plausible were found in a garage, those risks are dwarfed by the risks of storing classified documents in an active social club with hundreds of members that hosted weddings, fundraisers, etc. In other filings Thursday, Smith's team rejected additional Trump arguments seeking to dismiss the case, including the former president's claim that he is immune from presidential or from prosecution for acts committed in office. Prosecutors say there's no legal support for Trump's immunity claim, particularly in a case like this one, where the charges involve conduct that occurred after he left the White Office. Every criminal charge in the superseding indictment is based upon conduct in which Trump engaged after he left office. Even if a former president could claim some immunity from criminal prosecution for official acts, and he cannot, Trump could not benefit from any such immunity in this case.
And one short here. Plane makes emergency landing in L.A. after losing tire during takeoff. The United Airlines jetliner bound for Japan made a safe landing in Los Angeles on Thursday after losing a tire while taking off from San Francisco. Video shows the plane losing one of the six tires on the left side main landing gear assembly seconds after takeoff. The tire landed in an employee parking lot at San Francisco International Airport, where it smashed into a car and shattered its back window before breaking through a fence and coming to a stop in a neighboring lot. No one was injured, airport spokesman Doug Yackel said in a statement. Fire engines stood by at Los Angeles International Airport, but weren't needed, as the Boeing 777 made an uneventful landing and stopped about two-thirds of the way down a runway. Airport spokesman Dave Levine said the plane landed safely. It was then towed away. The flight carried 235 passengers and a crew of 14, United said. The airline said that the plane, built in 2002, was designed to land safely with missing or damaged tires. And that's time now for us to take a short break. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Your readers have been Barb Martin and Dennis May. And now we'll take a little break to let our next readers get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Jim Hoffman, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. We're going to continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. And here's Jim with our next article.
Thank you, Rachel. Good morning, everyone. We're going to look at the opinion page of the USA Today. Start out with an article written by Dace Potus. He's an opinion fellow for USA Today, also president of the Lone Conservative, the largest conservative student-run publication in the country. And he writes, "With Haley out, I won't vote in November." After a resounding series of losses on Super Tuesday, Nikki Haley announced that she was suspending her campaign for president, locking in the Donald Trump versus Joe Biden rematch that America was dreading. Despite surprisingly winning both Washington, D.C. and Vermont in the Republican primary, Haley's deficit of delegates against Trump was too much to overcome in the race for the GOP nomination. Republican primary voters were too consumed by the promise of what they would call the glory years of Trump's presidency, returning to truly evaluate Haley's campaign for what it was: our best chance at denying a second Biden term and retaking the White House in November. Haley is better suited to beat Biden in November. The fact that Trump was able to win the GOP nomination while under four criminal indictments, refusing to step on a debate stage, and still refusing to concede his last election, serves as a testament to how strong his grip on the party base is. Unfortunately, for the countless principled Republicans like myself, we cannot justify a vote for Trump, no matter how bad a Biden presidency has been. I find myself now in the middle of two candidates I view as severely damaging to the future of our country. There is no doubt that Haley, a former South Carolina governor and U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, was better poised to win in a general election against Biden than Trump is. A poll last month showing her beating Biden in a head-to-head election. Haley also is far more palatable to centrists than both Trump and Biden, and was even capable of capturing a significant portion of voters who favor Biden over Trump. Haley was not my first choice for president, but she was far from my last. I certainly prefer her to Trump as the Republican nominee, and it's frustrating that the GOP base is entirely unconcerned with electability when selecting their candidate. However, what has become abundantly clear this time around is that a significant portion of Republican voters would rather lose the elections than abandon Trump, and that is a pill the anti-Trump conservatives have to swallow. For young conservatives like me, the only choice we've known for president is Trump. While a majority of Gen Z Republicans support the former president, the GOP has a major numbers problem when it comes to my generation, spanning from 1997 to 2012. Polling shows that only 21% of Gen Z identifies as Republican, compared with 36% as Democrats. The 30% of Gen Z who identifies as independent is unlikely to support Trump in large numbers come November. But Haley's support among independents could have unlocked a new source of votes for the GOP. Even if Trump loses this year, a strong possibility, the loyalty expressed in this cycle gives me no reason to think we won't see a repeat in 2028. I honestly don't know what will break through to those who support Trump anymore. The only way to be rid of Trump at this point might be for him to win an election and be precluded from running for a third term. Until then, it seems the GOP is stuck with Trump as our perpetual nominee. Instead of winning elections, the GOP is relying on Democrats to lose them. Instead of appealing to new voters, the GOP will rely on the same base it always has. If neither party will give us candidates worth voting for, I simply won't.
The second editorial today is Gaza Hospital Workers Inspired Me as I Treated Palestinians. This is written by Dr. Thayer Ahmad. He's a Palestinian-American emergency medicine specialist in Chicago. In January, he volunteered on a MedGlobal medical mission to Gaza. He writes, I witnessed firsthand the horror and suffering facing the Palestinian people in Gaza while working for nearly 3 weeks in January with MedGlobal's WHO emergency medical team delegation in the defunct and catastrophically damaged Nasser Hospital. Nasser was the second largest hospital in Gaza and at the time of my visit was one of two remaining major hospitals in the south. I found a facility operating at three times its capacity with thousands of internally displaced people in and around the hospital. We treated victims of trauma on the floor because of the lack of hospital beds, and every day there were scores of injured and wounded. Our ability to appropriately treat our patients was severely compromised. I found myself staring at my patient, my shoes covered in blood, not sure how I could do what I was supposed to do. If it wasn't for the awe-inspiring example set by my Gazan colleagues, I'm not sure I would have been able to even function, much less meaningfully contribute. I came away inspired and moved by the resilience, compassion, and brilliance of the medical workers I met. These selfless, unpaid providers persevered and cared for patients despite nearly 400 of their healthcare colleagues being killed in Gaza since the Israel-Hamas war began on October 7th. Bombs dropped all around us, shaking the hospital building. Windows and walls were damaged by shrapnel and shells. At the end of my stay, tanks had surrounded the perimeter of the medical complex. Yet, if you were to take a snapshot of Nurse Shadi wrapping the infected hand of a toddler, you would never be able to tell that the Gazan sky was falling. It was surreal to see Dr. Moaz joke with a patient struggling with chronic pain and bring him a cup of tea. Life for the Palestinian people was destroyed and disrupted in every way. Yet these healthcare workers were the light trying to drive out the darkness. Virtually every civilian in Gaza is struggling with food insecurity, dependent on the minimal amount of aid that enters. UNICEF recently found that 1 in 6 children younger than 2 in northern Gaza is acutely malnourished. Many people skip meals for more than 24 hours. Despite the scarcity of food, Gazans' generosity and hospitality were on full display during my stay. Every night, nurses from the intensive care unit would insist that I join them for dinner. They would put together a family meal that consisted of beans, bread, and dates for all of us to share. They always insisted that I eat first and that I eat to my fill. I was their guest, and they took the obligation of hosting me very seriously, even if it cost them desperately needed sustenance. We would talk about Gaza before the war, their hopes for the war to end soon, and what they had planned for the future. They still had dreams and the energy to serve. As the Israeli military surrounded Nasser, my last few nights there were tumultuous. The bombing had reached the perimeter of the medical complex. Tanks were visible from the hospital windows, and the sound of gunfire and airstrikes was deafening. I lay on the floor in my room and was convinced that I wouldn't make it out alive. There was a knock on the door from Dr. Nahed, the director of surgery who had come to check on me. As smoke filled the hospital hallways, he looked at me with a smile on his face. "Don't worry, Thayer. Everything will be okay, and we will get you home." As I prepared to head back home to Chicago, I wondered why they weren't evacuating and leaving the hospital. Their lives were in danger, with a high risk of being killed or injured. Yet the medical staff at Nasser were not going anywhere. Many had been at other hospitals that had suffered similar fates and had come to Nasser to keep working. They were not going to abandon their patients or allow them to be displaced again. They knew that it might cost them their lives, but they felt it was their duty to continue serving in this role. Ultimately, the siege of Nasser concluded with Israeli soldiers raiding the hospital and rendering it inoperable. The last remaining surgeon, Dr. Khalid, whom I met during my January visit, recently shared an audio message describing the harrowing scenes as the hospital was raided. There was no food, water, or electricity, and 150 patients needed medicine and care that were not available. He was not asking for evacuation, just for the lights to be turned back on and for the ability to care for his patients. He asked that we help advocate for them in whatever capacity we could. When you think of Gaza, I hope you can remember the selfless and incredible people who will stop at nothing to help and heal. They need us to call on our elected officials, professional societies, and anyone who will listen to help ensure their safety and security. Their lives and those of their patients depend upon it. Again, that was by Dr. Thayer Ahmad, who's a Palestinian-American emergency medical specialist in Chicago who spent January volunteering on a medical mission in Gaza.
Thank you, Rachel. And turning to sports, and we have the sports schedule. There's a lot of things on. I'll try to hit some of the highlights here. Today at 4 p.m. on FS1, we have the NASCAR Cup Series practice. At 8 p.m., the Menards Series General Tire 150 at Phoenix being broadcast. College basketball, there's quite a few games. At 5 o'clock, CBS Sports Network, we have Akron at Western Michigan. And on ESPN2 at 6 o'clock, Virginia Commonwealth at Dayton. 8 o'clock, CBS Sports Network, Kent State at Toledo. ESPNU, the Ohio Valley Tournament is on. For women's basketball, there's lots of tournaments going on right now. The Big Ten Tournament, of course, up in Minneapolis, on the Big Ten Network, 11:30 today. Ohio State plays to be decided. Those games were played yesterday at 2 o'clock in the Big Ten Tournament on BTN. Michigan plays, and the one here in Iowa that interests everyone. Big Ten Network at 5:30, Iowa will play Penn State to see if they can move forward. And then college hockey on FS2, 6 o'clock, the Big Ten Tournament, Penn State at Minnesota, quarterfinal round. At 9 o'clock, CBS Sports Network, Denver at Colorado. And then horse racing, FS2 at 2 o'clock today, America's Day at the Races. We have Major League Baseball at noon, spring training game between the Yankees and Toronto on the Major League Baseball Network. And at 7 o'clock on the same network, Cincinnati against the L.A. Dodgers spring training game. NBA basketball at 6:40, ESPN, Minnesota at Cleveland. Hockey today, 8 o'clock tonight, Minnesota at Colorado on the National Hockey League Network. And finally here in soccer, men's soccer at 7:45, FS2, the Saudi Pro League, Al-Hilal at Al-Riyadh. So lots of things to see on TV for sports today. The Register's Athletes of the Week, Levin and Berggren, are the Athletes of the Week. This written by Joe Randleman of the Register. Solon girls basketball player Callie Levin and Bondurant for our boys basketball player Tanner Berggren were voted the Des Moines Register's Iowa Ortho Female and Male Athlete of the Week winners for this past week, February 26th to March 3rd. Levin won Female Athlete of the Week with 68% of the vote. Clear Creek Amana girls basketball player Ava Locklear came in second with 28%. Levin led the Solon girls to the 3A state championship by averaging 18.7 points, 5 rebounds, and 4.3 assists, 1.7 steals per game. Levin saved her best performance for her last, going for 27 points, 7 rebounds, 5 assists during their 54-47 victory over number 1 Estherville Lincoln Central in the 3A championship game. Berggren won Male Athlete of the Week with 76% of the vote. Cedar Rapids Kennedy boys basketball player Joe Bean took second with 9%. Berggren helped the defending 3A state champion Bondurant Farrar boys basketball team return to the state tournament with a thrilling 60-58 victory over third-ranked Adele DeSoto Minburn in the sub-state championship game on February 26th. He went for 25 points and 3 assists. He made 9 of 16 shots from the field, including 6 of 11 three-pointers.
Thanks, Jim. We have a few minutes. I'm going to try to read Randy Peterson's whole article on the sports page. ISU down by a bunch at halftime? Not a problem. Stars aligned darn near perfectly for an Iowa State men's basketball calamity against BYU on Wednesday night at Hilton Coliseum. The Big 12 conference tournament next week, which the Cyclones can legitimately win. The NCAA tournament the following week, in which T.J. Otzelberger's team can be a number 2 seed at Omaha. And there's more. A game out of first place in the tough Big 12 with 2 left, and first place Houston trailing UCF at the half in Wednesday night's early game. And did I mention it was senior night and a 17-game home winning streak the Cyclones were trying to extend? The situation was ripe for something bad for a team that's had oh so many wonderful moments, and for a half it looked like it. The defense was not what we'd been used to. BYU couldn't miss. Something clicked. Thoughts went back to a players-only preseason meeting during which goals were discussed. Goals like being unbeaten at home and winning the Big 12. Boom. A huge second half, especially on defense, made all that possible again after a 68-63 victory at Hilton Coliseum. Winning streak? Check. Big 12 title possibility? Check. One game to go? Buckle up. Not only for Saturday against the Kansas State Accusers, but for what lies beyond. It's going to be one wild ride that, quite honestly, could lead to the ultimate, the Final Four. It's pretty awesome to be going into the last game of the season and to be in a position to give yourself a chance to potentially win a conference championship, Coach Otzelberger said in likely what was the first time this season he allowed himself to look toward the future. Man, we all do this for a long time, and it doesn't happen much. And then to do it in the best league in the country, really awesome opportunity ahead of us on Saturday. If Iowa State sweeps the Wildcats, which means winning in Manhattan on Saturday, and if Houston loses at home, and Kelvin Sampson's team never loses at home against Kansas, and if Texas Tech wins at Baylor, then Iowa State and Houston tie for the title, and the Cyclones have the tiebreaker based on winning percentages against third-place teams. That's three stars that must align perfectly, and all must happen on the road. Long shot, the longest, but still possible. Anything within the bounds of possibility with this team that enters the regular season's finale, a game behind Houston in the Big 12 standings. Not bad, eh, for a team the coaches picked to finish seventh? As for the all-Big 12 teams, which, sorry, I have to turn the page, will be announced starting Sunday night, if Otzelberger isn't unanimous coach of the year, then the coaches need their heads examined. That's how slam dunk that voting should be. That's the kind of job Otzelberger has done during his third season at master control of a program that went to the Sweet 16 during his first season on the job. What happened Wednesday night was a perfect example of the adversity his team has successfully battled this season. It was a perfect example why his peers shouldn't have a problem with their Coach of the Year choice. Down 14 points in the second half? No problem. Can't play a lick of defense in the first half? Stuff happens. All factors like that have hardened this 9-player rotation. They've made this team resilient and given them the confidence that nothing is unsurmountable. I'm going to skip ahead. Oh yeah, the crowd was jacked for this one too. The better Iowa State played in the second half, the more jacked it became. At times, you couldn't carry on a conversation with the person seated next to you. That's how loud it was. To me, the loudest of a very loud season. "We've put ourselves in great position," Otzelberger said. "We're going to be ready to be at our best on Saturday, to do what we can on our end to finish the regular season." Sorry I had to skip just a little bit of Randy Peterson's report. It's time to turn to Dear Abby for today. There are two letters and responses, so I'll read the first one, Jim, if you'll take the second. "Dear Abby, I have known my husband for 10 years. We have been married for 4. We love each other very much, but I did something that has caused him to no longer trust me, and he won't forgive me. I went to a pub while my husband was at a class. I told him I was going to the pub, and he was fine with it. We know everybody who works there very well. The problem is, a nice man sat down a seat away from me, and we started talking about all kinds of stuff. At the end of the evening, we exchanged phone numbers. He texted me a week later wanting to know if I could meet him for lunch. I said yes. Big mistake. But we didn't meet because I realized it would be wrong. My husband saw his text on my phone and he is upset and angry. He hasn't spoken to me since. It's been almost a week. He said he can no longer trust me and he won't accept my apologies or forgive me. What can I do? Signed, Losing Love in California." Abby says, "Dear Losing, although your intentions may have been innocent, for your husband to have found out about the planned lunch the way he did couldn't have been worse. Had you told him you met someone nice and had been invited to lunch, it might not have made him angry. I don't blame him for feeling he may not be able to trust you. Remind him that you did not go to that lunch. Tell him you love him and ask what you need to do to earn back that trust. Ask if he would go to counseling with you. However, if you are unable to do that, accept that your marriage is toast." What a shame.
And our second letter, "Dear Abby, my sister Claudia recently asked me on a Saturday to take her to the eye doctor the following Tuesday. Well, I forgot. She didn't call me the night before, like normal people do, to remind me, nor did she call me the next day to confirm. She did not call her cousin to take her. She should have called me that day instead of calling our cousin. Now Claudia is mad at me. I think it was both our faults. Mine because I forgot. There is a lot going on here. My mother-in-law, who has dementia, lives here, and it has grown worse. It was also Claudia's fault for not calling me. She told me it was an important follow-up appointment, and she was really upset. Is she being childish? By the way, Claudia is 13 years older than I am and has always been jealous of me. Please give me your opinion. Signed, just plain Forgot, in Ohio. And Abby writes, Dear Forgot, oh my goodness, you are human and you forgot. I don't think it was a hanging offense. However, Claudia managed to come up with a plan B and the cousin saved the day. See how resourceful she can be in a pinch? In the future, when your hands are full, and from what you have described about your mother-in-law, it's safe to assume they will be, when Sissy asks you to take her to a medical appointment, perhaps Plan B should become Plan A.
And that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone is Jim Hoffman. Earlier, you heard Barb Martin and Dennis May. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.